here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ben. Before we get started, I just wanted to apologize because we had some background noise that I couldn't quite get rid of fully in the final edit of this episode. You'll know it when you hear it. I apologize. I did my best. Sometimes this stuff happens, but sorry about that. Hopefully you stick with us. Okay, here is today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, September 17th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst, Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, let's get into it. Let's start off with some box office stuff. Why don't you walk me through the top 10 at the box office this past weekend?
Will do. And as with last week, I believe we're going to go over the actuals for the weekend, whereas a lot of times on Mondays we'll go over the estimates. But now the actuals are out there. So the actual numbers for this past weekend at the box office: Beetlejuice topped the box office for a second weekend in a row with $51.3 million, representing just shy of a 54% drop. That's a little bit of a steep-ish drop, but not bad for a movie that opened to $111 million. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Number two was Speak No Evil, Blumhouse's latest and a remake of the 2022 movie of the same name. That underperformed a little bit with $11.3 million. Blumhouse is in what you could maybe accuse of being a bit of a rut here. We can talk about that a little bit more later if you'd like. Number three, a movie called Am I Racist made a surprise $4.5 million on just 1,500 screens. So it did almost $3,000 per screen.
Is it a good per screen average?
It's very good for something like this. This was basically no mainstream advertising whatsoever. For listeners that maybe haven't heard of this movie, it is from Ben Shapiro's company, The Daily Wire. It is very much a right-wing mockumentary. I tend to talk about box office without sort of cultural framing really and bringing myself into it, but depending on where you lean politically or culturally, this is probably a hot button sort of movie. We can leave it at that for now, but it clearly resonated with a certain chunk of audiences in North America.
Sure.
At number four was Deadpool and Wolverine, $3.8 million in its eighth weekend, with about a 45% drop there. The movie's starting to fall off, but it did cross the $1.3 billion mark worldwide and is now firmly in the top 25 all time. At number five, we have Reagan still holding strong with another $2.9 million, about a 40% drop there. It has amassed $23.2 million domestically, which is pretty good for a movie, again, with very little mainstream advertising. Number six, another bummer for Lionsgate, as The Killer's Game, its new assassin comedy starring Dave Bautista, debuted to just $2.6 million on a $30 million budget. After what happened with The Crow and Borderlands, it is shaping up to be a bit of a rough year for Lionsgate. Maybe their worst year ever in some ways.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not great. So we can talk about that more in a second, too, if you'd like. But number seven, we had Alien Romulus still holding pretty well in its fifth weekend with another $2.3 million, about a 40% drop there. It is at just past the $100 million mark domestically. It's at $331 million worldwide, and over 100 of that has come from China. Pretty crazy stuff. Number eight is It Ends With Us with another $2 million, dropping 45% in its sixth weekend. That one is at $145 million domestically and $325 worldwide. Again, that movie had a $25 million budget, probably the most profitable movie of the year. Number nine, The Forge, still holding strong, surprisingly, with $2 million in its fourth weekend, dropping about 32%. It is at $24.1 million domestically. And at number 10, yet another conservative movie here in God's Not Dead and God We Trust, the latest in that franchise, $1.4 million debut on just shy of 1,400 screens. So kind of a so-so per screen average of just over $1,000. Not quite what they've come to expect for that franchise at this point, but kind of shows, you know, I think that's the fifth movie in that series. So, you know, he might be sort of showing signs of wear there with the audience. Only other thing I would point out, and maybe we start with this, is that A24's The Front Room, which we briefly talked about last week, made just $427,000 in its second weekend on over 1,600 screens. It dropped 73% and made just $263 per screen. It has made less than $3 million across the first 10 days of its release. It is one of the worst rollouts ever for a movie that opened on more than 2,000 theaters.
Wow.
Top 20. It's hard to sort of cobble some of that information together. I looked a little bit. I struggled to find a movie that opened on 2,000 screens that did this poorly in its second weekend. I'm not saying it's never happened, but I'm saying we are in firmly like all-time bad territory. So I'm not super sure, but I would wager that A24 just dumped that one sort of knowing that it wasn't going to resonate. The only positive there is that it probably wasn't very expensive. A24 tends to make those horror movies pretty cheap, you know, probably less than 10 million, if not closer to 5 million. Maybe that's me hoping. But yeah, that's absolutely brutal. I don't want to pick on it too much and talk about it a lot more, but worth pointing out that one really didn't work out.
Yeah. I wonder if that idea that they just kind of dumped it in September, I think we were talking at the end of August and you said that like September has been historically kind of a dead month at the box office, broadly speaking, I guess is a fair way to characterize that. And I also wonder if that historical precedent for studios kind of largely avoiding this corridor of the year with like really big flashy stuff may have been why all of those like explicitly right-wing movies that you mentioned were able to sort of sneak into the box office top 10 with like not great. I mean, you're talking like $4 million or something like that. So this is not like these movies are making money hand over fist. It's just kind of like, there's not really a ton of impressive opposition at the box office, right?
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. And you even have stuff like, you know, Killer's Game sort of way underperforming. Cause I mean, Lionsgate definitely did press for that. Bautista was everywhere doing press for that. It's definitely an odd weekend. Speak No Evil, I mean, boy, Blumhouse and Universal really rolled out an ad campaign for that one. Reviews were good. Even people that liked the original and were skeptical of the remake, such as myself, seemed to like it. It's a bleak movie, no doubt, but that hasn't stopped other horror movies in the past from breaking out a little bit bigger. That's one of the bigger surprises of the weekend to me. I don't know what to make of Blumhouse right now, you know, between Night Swim, Imaginary, and recently Afraid, which I think we talked about. They just haven't really had a non-franchise breakout in a good while. And I don't really know what's going on there. Luckily, Blumhouse keeps things cheap, so they'll be fine. But they're not really going to make a lot of money from these movies that are just kind of nickel and diming their way through theaters. So, you know, kind of an off year for them, too. I'm not really sure what's going on there, but
We have an article up on Slash Film called Horror Heavy Hitter Blumhouse is Having a Rough Year. Here's Why 2025 Will Be Better. So I'll drop that in the show notes if people want to read more about that. And hopefully there will be, brighter days ahead.
2025 will be better for them for sure, with Megan 2.0 and some of these other things coming down the pipeline that are, you know, like pretty much slam dunks. I believe Five Nights at Freddy's 2 is on the calendar next year. That'll be an absolute home run. So, you know, but that's leaning on franchise stuff. I think they've got to find a way to get one of these originals to pop off again. But, looking at the positives here, Beetlejuice is now at 187.7 domestic, which makes it one of the top 10 domestic movies of the year so far already, just after two weekends. 264.2 worldwide. What's interesting here is that this movie has made less than 30% of its money internationally so far. So it is playing heavy, heavy, heavy domestic. It's rare to see a split that big these days. The only one that's come close to that this year is Twisters, which is which Warner Brothers is also distributing overseas. And Twisters, just for context, has made 266.3 domestic and 102.4 international. So It's a very similar split there. I don't know what it is with some of these movies not really finding an audience overseas. These seem like very America-centric movies to me. Although I did assume Beetlejuice would have found more of an audience overseas over the years, but I guess I was wrong about that. Ultimately, it'll still be fine with the $100 million budget. It's just, it's not going to be like a billion-dollar hit, you know, because you're not getting that 70%, you know, overseas grosses or whatever. But still very good. Tim Burton's biggest hit in years, stands to become at least his third biggest movie ever, passing Batman by the end of its run. That's good news. It means Burton might get a blank check to do something cool next. Who knows? So
did you see that story about Tim Burton basically like turning down the option of having a bigger budget to take Beetlejuice directly to streaming?
Yeah, I was a little confused on some of that. So what I know, what for sure came out of that report is that Warner Brothers seemed to believe that a Beetlejuice sequel was a better fit to go direct to streaming on Max. That alone is insane. The original budget, I guess, was supposed to be around $140 million, and it seems like the implications might have been that they were okay spending more money if they didn't have to put it in theaters, which I just don't... Money doesn't make sense to me at that point, if that's what they were thinking. Like, that can't possibly be what it was. But basically, to get it for a theatrical release, Burton had to find a way to get the budget to $100 million or less, which they did. A lot of the cast took, you know, lesser upfront money in favor of back-end deals to make it work. To me, it's shocking that you still have to work that hard to get a movie to $100 million, but it's good that they did, and I think it shows that you can. And I think that's important. Like, these things don't have to be so upfront expensive. So that to me is good. It is absolutely insane if for some reason the thinking was $140 million for streaming makes sense. $100 million, I don't know. I mean, does that make, can you make that make sense to me?
Can't, man, because you would think that, especially with a movie like that, that has enough nostalgia and sort of like built in awareness around it, that you're going to at least make that money back in your theatrical run, even if it performs terribly out of the gate. Like, over the course of its theatrical lifetime, you have to assume that that's going to be, I don't know. I feel silly weighing in on this because I clearly don't know as much about this topic as, first of all, as you, but also as the people who, you know, this is their full-time job to analyze and assess this stuff. So they clearly thought something, and then thankfully Tim Burton made the right call and was able to sort of take that trade off and do something pretty amazing with it.
Yeah.
Just a weird idea.
The reason I'm so surprised, if you were to say a $100 million budgeted movie with a theatrical release or a $100 million budgeted movie direct to streaming, to me, even with the equivalent budget, you always go theatrical. And I understand that means more spend as far as marketing goes, but we have shown time and time and time and time and time again that movies that play in theaters, even if they don't purely profit, do better at every single level after theatrical. They do better on VOD, they do better on DVD, they do better on Blu-ray, they do better on cable, and yes, they do better on streaming. So I simply don't understand how that's not a better investment, particularly for something like this. I don't know. Luckily, that thinking seems to be changing, because obviously this was a couple of years ago when this was just starting to finally kick off. So I think streaming's rationalized a lot since then. But I mean, that's one of those moments where you sort of realize how messy the thinking has been and how much they're willing to just set money on fire. I don't know. So,
Okay. So I did want to point out, you were talking about Lionsgate and like how iffy they're having how iffy of a year they're having. And I went to Lionsgate's website and I was looking at the movies that they have listed on their own website for what they have coming soon. And there are five movies here. One of them is Never Let Go, which is the Halle Berry horror movie that comes out this weekend. Megalopolis is the other one. White Bird, which is subtitled A Wonder Story, which is a sequel or loosely related in some way to the movie Wonder that came out in, 2018, 2019 or something like that, and made a shocking amount of money at the time. And then you've got The Best Christmas Pageant Ever and Mark Wahlberg's Flight Risk. So I don't want to disrespect Francis Ford Coppola on this podcast, but Megalopolis is not going to make a lot of money at the box office. I think it's probably fair to say that.
No, it is not.
And then White Bird, like, I want to say I saw a trailer for that at CinemaCon 2020 or like 2021 or something insane. It's been a long time for that movie to actually, like, it's been in the works for a long time and probably in the can for a long time. I don't know if they're going to be able to recapture the financial success that Wonder had with White Bird, because this is a whole different story. It's a period piece. It's like a whole different thing. And so what I'm saying is it doesn't really look like Lionsgate has any like slam dunk winners in the immediate future to help offset some of this.
Let's talk about that. So look, Never Let Go probably was cheap enough to do fine. You know what I mean? Like it's not going to be a big winner. And Megalopolis, let's not forget, no major studio wanted to sign up for that. So Lionsgate got a sweetheart deal to just distribute it for a fee. They are not invested other than they get paid for distributing it. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily going to look great that their name's attached to it, and it's not going to do particularly well, but that's kind of free money for them, if that makes any sense. Like whatever they get, it's sort of... White Bird is one that even if it makes a fraction of what the original did, it'll still be fine. Now, okay, so that gets you through, that gets you out of the bleeding out of 2024. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about 2025. Den of Thieves Pantera, which is the sequel to Den of Thieves. I think we're a little late on that. I would have liked to see that a couple of years ago, but okay, fine. Flight Risk, probably not going to do well. That's a January dump movie. But then we get to April, and that's when Michael comes out. And that movie is going to make $1 billion. Like, I try not to say that movie is going to make $1 billion. Then you have John Wick, Ballerina, the long-awaited spinoff there. That movie's going to do well. You have Saw 11. You have Now You See Me 3. You have the supposed Dirty Dancing sequel. Like, all of those seem far more bankable to me. So, much like in the way that Blumhouse has greener pastures on the horizon, I think Lionsgate absolutely has a much better year ahead of them next year. It's just that this year... boy, did they have some stickers all in a row. So, you know, hopefully they can sort of recover. But you're not wrong. That immediate slate for them through 2024 doesn't look any better. And that really is difficult. But, you know, hopefully if they can just kind of survive until mid next year, you know, then greener pastures are there for sure. So,
yeah. Excellent. Okay. Any other box office things? Okay.
No, I think that's pretty much all I've got. Yeah, because I think, as you mentioned, we have... Never Let Go coming out next week, but we also have a Transformers 1 coming out this upcoming weekend, which figures to do. It'd be interesting to see how that does. So that's something worth keeping an eye on, but that's all I got.
Cool. All right, let's take a break and then we'll be right back.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown. Ooh. And your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah.
All for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Hortons. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
All right, so two news stories that I wanted to talk to you about, Ryan. First of all, James Cameron is planning a non-Avatar-related movie. His intention is to direct a film that I believe is going to be called Last Train from Hiroshima, which is, this sounds like a brutal story. I had never heard this before, but evidently this is based on a real story of a Japanese guy who lived in Hiroshima, survived the atomic bomb in August of 1945, traveled by train to the nearby city of Nagasaki, and then survived that atomic bomb detonation there as well, which is just brutal to even comprehend. But James Cameron met this guy, I think his name is Sotomo Yamaguchi, and he said, "It's a subject that I've wanted to do a film about, that I've been wrestling with how to do it over the years. I met Yamaguchi, a survivor of both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, just days before he died. He was in the hospital. He was handing the baton of his personal story to us. So I have to do it. I can't turn away from it." So very, very serious subject matter there. But also, I'm kind of excited to see what James Cameron does in a non-Avatar playground. You know, he seemed to basically, I don't know if he ever officially said this, but he kind of signaled in the press that he was only going to be making Avatar movies for the rest of his career because that world is so all-encompassing and expansive that he could basically use it to tell whatever kind of stories that he wanted to tell and get whatever messages that he wanted to get across. He could do those within the context of the Avatar universe. And this seems like a project where he's obviously stepping away from that. And so that's exciting to me. I mean, I like the Avatar movies. We've talked about those on the past before, or on the podcast in the past before, but yeah, this is just like, oh, James Cameron returning to a different type of filmmaking. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on this subject at all.
They can be boiled down to fuck and yes. I am not a big Avatar guy, as longtime listeners of this podcast will know. I was very happy to hear this. I have my doubts about him being able to somehow do this, you know, unless Disney takes a longer break before greenlighting like Avatar 4 and 5, and he can somehow like squeeze this in. I don't know, but James Cameron is such a good filmmaker, and it is like a tragedy to me that he's going to spend most of the rest of his career making stuff I don't care about. You know, all due respect to people who like those movies, but this to me is like, you know, hell yeah, after seeing what, you know, like a guy like Nolan did with Oppenheimer. I know this is like an easy comparison to make, but this is almost like, you know, the other side of that coin in some way from an equally legendary filmmaker. Like, absolutely, yes. Like, I'm so happy that he's at least thinking about what could I do that isn't Avatar. And this sounds like a great story, and I very, very, very much hope this actually happens.
And whereas Oppenheimer was told from an American perspective, Cameron has said that he wants this to be told from the Japanese perspective for a change. So that is definitely going to be different in terms of where the center of this story is set, I suppose. So there's that. And then the last story that I want to bring up here is one that I just saw the headline for. I haven't had a chance to really dig into the details here, but the war between Coke and Pepsi is getting a movie from the most unlikely duo imaginable. Ryan, can you tell me what that unlikely duo, who that consists of?
Yeah, so this is something we heard a little bit about earlier this year, that Sony had bought a pitch for a movie called Cola Wars, which is, as you could probably guess, is about the war between Coke and Pepsi, largely in the 80s, is my understanding. Well, now we know who's going to direct that movie. And Judd Apatow of the 40-Year-Old Virgin fame is going to direct Cola Wars. And Steven Spielberg, through Amblin Entertainment, is going to produce this movie. That's where things get, like, where you're forced to raise an eyebrow. Like, Judd Apatow directing a movie like this doesn't seem so out of line. Spielberg producing a movie like this with Judd Apatow directing is fascinating. All we have so far is like what was in the pitch for the movie, like what was bought. So as Deadline reports, it is the true story of Pepsi's attempt to challenge Coca-Cola's century-long reign as the world's top cola. It uncapped the Cola Wars of the mid-1980s, which included everything from Michael Jackson's fiery mishap to the new Coke debacle, as the ultimate underdog tale of history's most iconic second-place contender, Pepsi, vying for the number one spot, Coca-Cola. Jason Schumann of Winning Time fame and Ben Queen, who has quite a few writing credits, including The Addams Family 2, are penning the screenplay. That's kind of what we know right now. No word on how soon production could get going, but it does seem like this is kind of barreling forward, so I would expect sooner rather than later, but that's where we're at.
Yeah, this is so interesting because you've got Unfrosted, the Jerry Seinfeld Netflix movie that just came out about Pop-Tarts and the breakfast wars basically, and then Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg executive produced a movie called Console Wars back in 2020 that was like a documentary about Nintendo versus Sega. And so, yeah, this is just like the latest in what seems to be a growing line of movies about real world competitions between brands, which is just like not anything that I would have expected to be a sort of quasi trend that's coming out of Hollywood. But yeah, as you say, here we are. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I think my thing is, if you sort of take the versus concept out of it, I think of it more as like, there's this idea of like, the creation of things. So see, even going back to like The Social Network, or if you look at like Dumb Money, sort of like the documenting the meme stock thing, or again, a movie I brought up a lot, BlackBerry from last year, which is my favorite movie of last year, which was about the BlackBerry smartphone. And so
and this, Air as well, the Ben Affleck movie,
which is the other one I was going to bring up. So it's this idea of like how these iconic things sort of came to be, and Pepsi, even its own right, is there in its own way. And so I think that it's actually not that hard to see why you would maybe do a movie like this, because in fairness, Air was excellent. BlackBerry was probably the best movie that nobody saw last year. And I still encourage people, please go see BlackBerry out. And like, so there's possibility here. Like, of course, like there's a lot of fuel for this fire. It all depends on how it's treated. Like if you had told me that my favorite movie last year was going to be the movie about how they made the BlackBerry, a phone I never owned, I wouldn't have believed you. So like, you know, Judd Apatow's made some great movies where I understand that there is a difference between Steven Spielberg, the producer, and Steven Spielberg, the director, but like, you know, his company's not going to sign on for nothing, right? Like there must be something here. So I don't know. I'm compelled by this, I must say. I do think if they treat it more serious, but with irreverence, like I can see if they don't go the unfrosted route is I guess what I'm getting at, but like there's a movie here. I think I can see it. It sounds silly, but you got to get attention somehow. And that's one way to do it. So I don't know. I find this fascinating, and I'm kind of all in the bag for this one. Like this is probably one of those ones, unless it just looks atrocious, like they kind of have my money already. So
yeah, it's been a little while since I've really been invested in anything that Judd Apatow has directed. I'm looking back at his filmography. Like he directed a George Carlin documentary in 2022. There was something called Bob and Don, a Love Story in 2023 that I have no memory of. The Bubble, which kind of like doesn't exist as far as I'm concerned, it came out in 2022. The Pete Davidson movie, The King of Staten Island, was in 2020. I mean, you got to go back to 2015's Trainwreck before you get back to a movie that he directed that I really liked or was invested in. So I would love to love a new Judd Apatow directed movie again. So fingers crossed this turns out to be the one.
Yeah, I would go to bat for that George Carlin documentary though, for those that haven't seen it. Okay. It is quite good. But there's a lot of love for comedy in that. And I think Apatow has a lot of love for comedy in that. As a guy who was a little not the most studied of George Carlin, that was a good way. That was kind of why I got into that. But
cool. Yeah, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about all the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked inside the show notes for this episode. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps out a lot. And tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.